Karo History New Zealand podcast. This is Catherine Knight. It's been a long time since my last podcast of September 2010. A lot seems to have happened since, which has brought into focus for me the important link between environmental history and our understanding of the environment in both its natural and built forms today. So in this episode, I would like to explore what I see as the critical importance of environmental history as a basis to inform the decisions about how we shape and how we live within the environment. An obvious case in point is, of course, the Christchurch earthquake of February this year. On February the 26th, I wrote a post about the environmental history of Christchurch and how the decision of our forefathers to site this city on a swamp may have come back to haunt us today. Christchurch was one of New Zealand's first cities. The first pioneering settlers made their home there in the 1840s, but it was in the 1850s that organised settlement began, with the first four ships from England arriving at Lyttelton Harbour. The founding fathers of Christchurch showed great foresight, laying out the city in a grid pattern with numerous parks, squares, and tree-lined avenues and waterways. No expense or labour was spared in the construction of the city's iconic buildings either. Many of these are the most beautiful examples of stone masonry in New Zealand and make the city the special place that it is. But much of that, literally, came crumbling down on the 22nd of February 2011. In what was technically only an aftershock of the September 2010 quake. This time the epicenter was in Lyttelton Harbour, much closer to the city than the September 2010 quake. Much of the damage was concentrated either in the inner city or along the city's many waterways. The root of much of this damage is liquefaction, a phenomenon whereby soil loses its strength and cohesiveness and takes on the constitution of liquid, usually in response to a major earthquake. A key factor which determines the extent of liquefaction is the depth of the water table. So, why would Christchurch be more prone to this than other cities? The answer is, of course, in its environmental history. Originally, the area that is now Christchurch was an extensive coastal wetland, thickly forested with matai and totara and other swamp forest species. However, much of this forest was burnt off, whether deliberately or accidentally, we do not know, by the earliest inhabitants of the area, the so-called moa hunters, or archaic phase Eastern Polynesians, who arrived in the area possibly around 1000 AD. By the time Europeans arrived in the 19th century, there were only isolated patches of forest, with a mixture of tussock grassland and swamp making up most of the area. One of the earliest descriptions of what was to become Christchurch is that of Captain W.B. Rhodes, whose bark Australian visited Port Cooper in September 1836. He climbed the nearest saddle of the Port Hills and saw a vast grassy plain with two small patches of forest, Riccarton and Papanui, and observed, "All the land that I saw was swamp and mostly covered with water." For that reason, as Geoffrey Rice points out in his book, Christchurch Changing, the earliest European settlements were on Banks Peninsula rather than down on the flats. But eventually, over the course of the subsequent decades, the settlers succeeded in draining the wetlands for farmland and settlements, and channeling the many waterways into two more orderly rivers, the newly named Avon and Heathcote. Their efforts to establish a vibrant, thriving, and attractive city were apparently successful, with Christchurch becoming the second largest city in New Zealand and its growth showing no signs of abating. And so it appeared that successive generations' efforts to subdue and control the natural environment that formed the foundations of Christchurch City was complete. But after a century and a half of more or less being kept under control, that nature has shown itself, combined with formidable seismic forces, to be far from subdued. In the post, I also referred to my experience in the massive earthquake that hit Kobe, Japan, in 1995, killing nearly 6,500 people. The link I made there was to the occurrence of liquefaction on the artificially created Rokko Island. The island was created literally by scooping earth from nearby hills and dumping it into the sea. In the earthquake, the soil from which it was constructed loosened up and moved, destroying buildings and infrastructure. This was another example of a human attempt to mould and manipulate nature, though on a more extravagant and cavalier scale, with similarly tragic consequences. However, the reference to this Kobe quake eerily foreshadowed the March 11 quake and tsunami only 3 weeks later, which wrought devastation, human loss and trauma on an almost unimaginable scale. It destroyed entire coastal towns in northeastern Japan, killed many thousands of people, and continues to grip much of the population in a state of trauma and abject fear in light of the ongoing threat posed by the crippled nuclear power plant in Fukushima. Like the Christchurch earthquake, this disaster raises questions about where and how to build towns, but also around the safety of nuclear power. But in this respect, Japan does not have the options that we as New Zealanders have. With a population of 127 million in a country not much larger than New Zealand, and only a relatively modest proportion of its highly mountainous country suitable for towns, cities, and infrastructure such as airports, it is difficult to know whether Japan will have any other option but to rebuild in the same coastal areas where it sustained such tragic loss of life. In respect to energy too, it has fewer options in a country like New Zealand, which has a population of only a 30th of Japan's, but is endowed with numerous rivers, an extensive coastline, and expansive windswept hill country, offering many options for electricity generation other than nuclear. With my strong links to both Japan and New Zealand, I hope that this will be a time for the two countries to share their knowledge, wisdom, and expertise to look forward to the future and to the building of towns, cities, and communities which take account of our environmental histories and are more resilient in the face of nature's forces. Perhaps more than anything, it is an opportunity to rediscover our humility as human beings, as merely an element of, not a controller of, nature. A humility that the seemingly limitless powers of technology and human innovation have led us to forget. This ends the fifth episode of the EnviroHistory New Zealand podcast. Thank you for listening and your ongoing support of the EnviroHistory New Zealand website. I hope you will join me for the next episode, which will introduce more of the stories and themes explored on the website. To read more about the articles discussed in this podcast and other articles exploring our environmental history, or to make a comment or contribution, go to http://envirohistorynz.wordpress.com.